Okay. Between, and upstairs. And upstairs.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Well, that's right.
Sounded a good one. I don't know. Recess when they have a vote.
Oh.
They're gonna come down and tell us when they need us for a vote.
Or you and I could just stay here.
That's true.
I'm assuming you're.
Sorry, I have an extra copy.
I won't be with you.
You're making a fair assumption.
Or vice versa.
Good in the pensions tonight too. Okay.
So finance is gonna come in.
Absolutely.
There is pension too.
Buildings?
Well, there shouldn't, no. Guess we'll see if we, all right. Okay, we are back in order in the Judiciary Committee and Senator Franzen is here. Senator Franzen, where are your donuts?
She didn't bring donuts.
Once again, Senator Limmer, you are well prepared, are you not?
I am, but I did not bring donuts. But then again, I've been on the committee for quite some time.
Yes.
So new people that have.
You have good questions for Senator Franzen, I think. Even though maybe she's just understanding we can't eat donuts here at the table anyway. Unlike the House where they actually would distribute them and consume them.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I did bring a hot dish this afternoon for lunch, so I hope you had a time to try it. So at least I brought some food for members.
I did try a hot dish. I will assume for your sake it was yours, and it was very good.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
There was one hot dish that I participated in that, well, let's just say it was rememberful. Not in a nice way. Which one was yours?
Let's hope you took care of that before the meeting started. Yeah.
It has some cream of something and Ritz crackers and a stick of butter.
I think that cream went bad.
Mm.
Senator Franzen, we have before us Senate File 319. Go ahead and you have an author's amendment to this, I understand. Why don't
I
take
do,
care of
the
that
A1
first?
Amendment.
The A1 amendment, members, is in your packets. It's an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Franzen, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is basically under current law, military members have to wait until they are honorably discharged from the military to take a reciprocity test from POST, which is the Peace Officer Standards and Training.
Okay.
If they wish to become a law enforcement officer in a non-military agency. What this bill seeks to accomplish is to allow military police to take this reciprocity test while on active duty. A person would not be guaranteed a position, and this would only open the door to take the test. Upon passage, a person would still have to undergo interviews and be offered employment. And finally, the bill requires a Form DD-214 document, which indicates an honorable discharge in order to be licensed. So you may ask why I bring this bill. Well, the reason is it directly affects one of my constituents and other men and women in a similar situation. And I'd like to introduce Staff Sergeant Christopher Geiger, who's going to talk about how this bill would affect him.
Welcome, Staff Sergeant Christopher Geiger. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, I'm Staff Sergeant Christopher Geiger. About 27 years old, married. I've been in the Air Force now for over 10 years. 7.5 of that has been active here in Minneapolis at the Air Reserve Station. All that time has been spent as a military police officer. As mentioned, I'm currently a staff sergeant. On my shift, I'm a Base Defense Operations Center controller, or also known as a desk sergeant. I'm also training to be a shift supervisor, and I'm also my shift's field training officer. And as Senator Franzen stated, I live in Edina. As well, and I've lived there since December of 2011. How this affects me is, right now, as the law states, I have to be out of the military to take the test. And with the uncertainty of passing a test after I get out. And with how this affects me also is, okay. Military is planning on taking away our aircraft. With the aircraft, myself, along with roughly 60 personnel that would qualify as well, will lose our jobs in the state and either be forced to leave the state or try to find a job. And with that, it would also help qualified people that are in the military worldwide that want to come back to Minnesota and work. They get the opportunity to test to see if they're eligible to be licensed before they get out of the military. to kind of help us all plan our futures.
So with that, I also like to ask for our testimony, Executive Director of the Minnesota Board and Peace Officer Standards and Training, Mr. Neil Melton.
Welcome, Mr. Melton, to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Neil Melton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training. We have been the licensing organization for law enforcement since 1977. Since the beginning, the Post Board has taken an active role in helping veterans. We thank them for their service, and we'd like to try to find ways to facilitate a transfer from their military career to a law enforcement career if they meet the criteria, such as the staff sergeant who does. For many years, we've offered a reciprocity exam that's based on military service of a certain type, military policing and so forth. And once they discharge from the service, that is, we've seen a copy of their DD-214, they would be eligible to take the examination. This law would simply move that process up and allow them to take the exam while they're still on active duty service. And once they get out of the military and we see proof of their DD-214, then they could begin the background process and the hiring process. So I've discussed this with the Post Board and the Post staff, and we support this legislation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Melton. Is there anything further, Senator?
That would be all. I think it's a good bill to support. It's supporting members of our military armed forces here and able to use their expertise and training and to serve the civilian life. So I think it's a win-win for the state and certainly something needed for people in the situation as the Staff Sergeant Christopher Geiger to be able to stay in the community. His wife lives here too. His family is here. So we don't want him to go to a different state because he's not able to keep his expertise here, and there's other people like him.
Thank you. I was taking over the chair, so I'm sorry if there was some disruption during the time in which you were testifying, but I think I'm oriented now. Is there anyone else here that wishes to testify in relationship to this bill? Senate File 319. Any questions from anyone from the two of us? Who remain here? Do we have any questions? Yes,
well,
go ahead,
not
Senator.
Necessarily a question, Madam Chair, but I did give my, a police chief a call and just to see where they were coming from, and they're all in support of this, so we're all excited that this sounds like a really good bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Hall.
Okay, Senator Hall, would you like to make a motion?
I would so move.
He makes the motion that Senate 319, as amended, pass mm-hmm. and be sent to the floor.
So
any
moved.
Further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Oh, yes, I forget. It passes. Thank you very much for your testimony. And I don't know, I assume that Senator Latz talked a little bit about what's happening tonight, that people are coming and going. From the committee, was there any discussion? There's another committee going on, the Finance Committee. Several members of this committee will be coming and going throughout the night, and it's not because we don't think these are important that they're being called to vote on various amendments to the exchange bill that is being heard in the Finance Committee.
Thank you.
So it passes. It goes to the floor, and we now, I guess you can stay there, right, Senator Franzen? You have another bill that you want to present on the uniform disposition of community property rights at death.
Yes.
So Senate File 350.
Madam Chair, thank you. For this particular bill, the bill focuses on ensuring that personal property maintained. Ensuring personal property rights are maintained when a married couple moves from a community property state to Minnesota, which is a common state law. So Minnesota, as I said, is a common state law. This means that for property to be jointly owned, both names need to appear in the title. Both names of a spouse and a husband and wife need to be on the title. For example, if a married couple owns a car, but only the wife's name is on the title, legally she is the owner of that car. Other states, including Wisconsin, which is just next door, have community property. And this means that each individual in the marriage is presumed to have 50% ownership of the property. So drawing from the previous example, if a married woman owns a car in Wisconsin and only her name is on the title, Both her and her husband are assumed to have 50% ownership of the car equally. This bill will say that when a person moves to Minnesota from a community property state like Wisconsin, their property will remain jointly held. This bill ensures that people aren't deprived of their property rights, then when they move to Minnesota from a community property state. With that, I'd like to ask to testify.
Mr. Nelson, Scott Nelson.
Thank you.
Thank you. Introduce yourself, Mr. Nelson, and who you're representing and what brings you to the table, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Scott Nelson. I'm an attorney and also a licensed CPA here in Minnesota. I work with the law firm of Makel, Krauts & Moore in downtown Minneapolis. And I'm here tonight on behalf of the Probate and Trust section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, which initiated this bill and has actually worked on it for about 3 years. It has gone through a very extensive vetting process through the Bar Association prior to it being submitted for consideration by the legislature, and I appreciate your time tonight in introducing the bill. Basically, as Senator Franson has described, what we're trying to do with this legislation is recognize existing common law nationwide, which basically says that the property rights of a husband and wife do not necessarily change when they change their state of residence. And what this bill recognizes is that there's 10 community property jurisdictions in the United States. Minnesota is not one of them. We're part of the other 40 states that are considered common law states. And the idea is that when community property spouses move into Minnesota, we will have a statutory mechanism that will recognize that their community property rights have not necessarily changed because of their move. And this statute is meant to provide a template primarily for attorneys who are representing decedents or their surviving spouses as to how to handle disposition of property that it turns out relates back to the community property rights that the spouses had at the time they acquired the property. And the act is fairly straightforward. It has about 13 sections. I'll just go through these very briefly. The first section talks about the application, and it makes clear that the state only has jurisdiction over personal property of individuals who are domiciled within the state and real estate which is situst or situated within the state. So that is clarified at the first section of the act. The second section has two rebuttable presumptions. The first is that if the property was acquired while the spouses were living in a community property state, that it remains to have its community property character, even though they may now be living in Minnesota. The other rebuttable presumption is that if they move to Minnesota and they change the title so that it's set up as joint tenancy with right of survivorship, which about 95% of our homesteads are set up as between a husband and wife, then it's presumed not to be community property any longer. So those are the two rebuttable presumptions in Section 2 of the Act. Section 3 of the Act just simply says that if it did retain its community property character under the community property law, that the decedent only has the right to dispose of their half interest in the property upon death. And then in Sections 4 and 5, we have provisions that basically put the burden on the party that is claiming that it's community property. So in other words, when somebody dies, and maybe to clarify at the outset, this act only applies to rights upon death. It doesn't impact the rights of spouses during lifetime. So if they get divorced, if they have creditor issues that arise during their lifetimes, if there's other issues that come up with the titling, this act does not apply. It only applies to what happens when one of the spouses dies and what are their rights to pass the title at that point. Sections 4 and 5 basically put the burden on the party that's claiming that certain property is community property by requiring them to provide notice. And basically, the notice requirements are 4 months after date of publication to creditors if there's a probate proceeding. And that actually coincides with the statute of limitations on creditor rights. If you publish notice and provide notice to creditors under our probate code, creditors have 4 months within which to file their claim, and this basically coincides with that time limitation. And then there's an alternative which says if the property is owned in a trust, that they have 60 days to assert their right to claim that it's community property rather than separate property. Section 6 protects bona fide purchasers and lenders. So again, if somebody loans money or secures an interest in the property according to Minnesota law, or if they're a bona fide purchaser for value, they're protected, and the fact that it may have been community property is not relevant to that third party. What happens is if, for example, they sell the property, the proceeds then would possibly be subject to community property claims by the party that would be asserting that right, but they wouldn't have the right to go after the bona fide purchaser or the lender who complied with Minnesota law in extending those rights. Section 7 simply says that creditors' rights are not impacted by this law. Section 8 basically says that married persons have the right to deal with the ownership of their property in whichever way they wish during their lifetimes. Section 9 basically is saying that they cannot expand their marital property rights through their will or trust. So whatever their pre-existing rights are at the time of death, they can't expand those just simply by trying to override that in a will or trust. Whatever the state statutes provide would prevail. And then the last two sections just talk about the description of the title and the intention to hopefully have uniformity of application among states that have enacted this. Overall, there's 14 states and the District of Columbia that have adopted this act over several years, and most of those are adjacent to community property states similar to Minnesota. I personally just left a law firm where I had offices in both Minneapolis and Hudson, Wisconsin, and so I dealt with this issue quite often. And the other attorney that worked quite extensively on this legislation with me, Roy Schoberg, has a practice in Woodbury and lives in Hudson. And again, he has a lot of clients that run into this situation. Of course, it's becoming more common with the number of residents that move back and forth or have properties either in Minnesota or Wisconsin, with Wisconsin being one of the community property states in the United States.
All right. Are there any questions? Senator Franzen, do you have any other witnesses to present in connection with your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I do not.
Are there any members of the audience that wish to be heard on this bill? Seeing none, is there a motion?
I'll move Senate File 350 and... I don't think it was an amended. There was not an amendment, it would be referred to the Senate floor.
That's correct. Any further discussion on Senate File 350? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
You are welcome. All right. We had rearranged the agenda because Senator Ortman wanted to be available, but she apparently has a conflict at the moment. So, Senator Chamberlain, are you ready to proceed on your bills? Senator Chamberlain, we will take up Senate File 131. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for hearing the bill.
Sure. Is this your first committee, Senator?
For this bill, Mr.
Yes.
Chair? This second committee.
Where did you come from?
We came from reform, tax reform.
Okay.
It's actually here for just one section.
Why don't we ask Ms. Pontius to identify for us the one section of your bill over which this committee has jurisdiction, and we'll focus our attention on that section.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, that is just section 4, which is on pages 6 and 7, because it's a data practices provision.
Section. Senator Chamberlain, why don't you give us just a brief description of what your bill does so we can put into context the provision that we'll be considering.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill, the original legislation was passed in 2010. It's a small business investment tax credit. Originally, it's also known as, better known as, angel investment credit. And the bill itself is pretty much, it targets small, fairly high-tech industries, businesses, and its intent is to encourage investment into these businesses, and then those persons who invest, the investors, would get a tax credit for that investment. And then as you go through the bill, there are limits and qualifications on what's a qualified business, what's a qualified investor, what's a qualified fund, and then there's certain limitations on what these businesses and investors can do and what they cannot do.
So your bill, in general, is making some modifications to those other provisions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
What comes before us is a change to the data privacy provision in the underlying angel investor tax credit legislation?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. I should say that the basic thrust of the bill is increasing the angel investment credit from $12 million to $17 million a year. And the section you have jurisdiction over, I have on starts on line 7-3. That's additional language. Previously, as you can see, all they required of the business was the name of the business, the qualified business that was receiving the investment. And this change, of course, adds a mailing address, telephone number, and a few other things. The intent of that is simply give investors some more information, access to these businesses, and perhaps some marketing opportunities, but mainly information for businesses, making that, including that in non-public data or public data. And the deed has been able to manage it without that. These changes, we believe, are fairly benign. You could go to a website and find this information. Any company in business, especially high tech, is going to have something on the internet. So, email and email addresses, mailing address, telephone numbers of the business is fairly benign. So that's why it's in there.
So, Senator Chamberlain, this is data which they are putting into their application to qualify for this kind of a tax credit for their investors. Is that it?
Yeah, the businesses would have to become certified, so they fill out an application. All this information would be on the application, so DEDA already has that information, but they're putting it on in the bill so that investors and other people would have access to that for, like I said, more information for investors and possibly some marketing opportunities.
And is it, Senator, is it your understanding then that the businesses that are seeking to be qualified probably want this information to be more available to potential investors? They'd like the idea that it becomes public, or have they expressed any concerns?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my understanding. I have not talked to all of them, but that is my understanding, yes.
Has anyone objected that you're aware of?
No, I have not received any comments or been approached by anybody in the last 2 months, no.
Are there any questions for Senator Chamberlain? Senator Sharon.
Maybe Senator Chamberlain cannot answer this question, and it's not specifically related to your proposal, because this is about being clear that this is public. This is treated as public information.
Yes.
Perhaps you could answer. Was it treated as private information before?
Yes, it was not included in this part of the bill that deals with data privacy. Indicated that certain things would be private information, non-public information, with the exception of items 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, that those items would not, those would be, that would be public information. So that is the change. So previously it was not public information.
And Senator Latz, if I may continue. Just for my clarification, so who then will we be giving permission to release this as public information? Who holds this information?
The deed Senator holds Chamberlain. The information. Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, the deed holds the information.
Thank you. The reason I'm asking, it's not related to your bill. There's another. This email stuff is, and what's public and what's private is a theme that's starting to come up in various bills. So what you're saying to me is that up to the point at which we pass this, a government agency was allowed to keep email addresses as non-public data unless we pass this bill. And there was a rationale for that at some time.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, yes, I don't know what the original rationale was for not including this in the original bill, but yes, there presumably was. And the rationale for this, like I said, is just additional information for investors. And I
thank you, Senator. I think this makes perfect sense. Okay. It's the other issue that we're struggling with that you're giving me. You aren't aware of this, but you're giving me a place to go to understand a rationale for keeping that private.
Sure.
Is what I'm under what conditions do you want to keep it private, and under what conditions should we not be concerned about it? So,
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon,
Senator,
as I mentioned, I don't know the original rationale, but the rationale here, if you went to a website for a business anyway, you'd probably be able to find it online. Where obviously we don't want that for the other individuals and other funds that are on there. Thank you.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chamberlain, on line 6, page 7, we reference the name of a qualified investor. Would there be any objection to mentioning the investor's name, phone number, email address, or contact person? And that, has there been any discussion about that?
Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I have not had any discussion with anybody about that particular issue. But again, those investors are private individuals. They can be private individuals. They can't be corporations, or they could be funds that hold dollars from past. It would be a pass-through fund to other investors or other LLCs or partnerships or S-Corps. So that is more of a personal individual. That would be more personal individual data.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
I think part of the reason why the name of a qualified small business was originally created was that these were public funds, and they're a little different than a private investment. They're a public investment. But I'm curious why a qualified investor who also would benefit from this public fund, why we would not make that public. I don't understand it, but maybe there's some reason. But we certainly know who the name of the qualified investor is due to existing law, but there's no other reference of
Mr.
contact
Chair,
information.
Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, the qualified investor, I guess it could be individuals, could be someone who takes part of a private investment fund, and the fund passes that, invests that money, and the credits pass back through to the investor. And again, they're individuals, and they file their tax returns and get the credits, and then the tax law and that data would be treated the same way. So we're trying to protect the individual investors, as opposed to a business who is out there in the public eye with this information readily available on websites.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any suggestions on what to do with this one, but I do know that there's other discussion going on in other legislation, especially around filing for campaign offices, that some people are considering when we as candidates write our statement of economic interest, we may have to reveal who our clients are if we have a private business. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's true, then maybe we should know more about a qualified investor. But until we resolve that, it's kind of an ongoing issue that hasn't been completely vetted. And so since that hasn't happened, I'll just kind of raise it for discussion purposes. But and I don't know how far you go on this either. Knowing my clients or my wife's clients for her business or my children's employer, I don't know if that has a whole lot to do with anything, but it kind of is related, and then again it's not, but it does eventually, it'll all filter back to how we handle the data and who has access and who does not.
Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lynn, one final comment on this, on that line is that it does have a purpose there, but my conversation with Deed and with the organization representing this, lobbying for this, is that it's good information to have. It's helpful, but they've operated and functioned without this information for the past several years. So, I mean, if it really makes all of you uncomfortable to that point, it's easy enough to just have an oral amendment and strike it. But that, I'll leave that up to you, to your expertise and your judgment. It's not the thrust of the bill, and there are other protections in there.
It's our job to ask tough questions, Senator Chamberlain. and as you can tell, the committee's had more than one data privacy question come before us already, and we're trying to put everything into context. I can see a distinction here as a business that has specifically applying for certain government benefits
right.
they wish to obtain. And there's more, in so applying, I can see there would be an appropriate expectation that certain information would become public.
That's right.
Just by virtue of that fact, different than simply applying to be on a listserv of some sort for notice as individual residents of a community. So I can see a distinction there. I think, Senator Limmer, you raised an interesting question about paragraph 2 on line 7.6. I don't know that we resolve that here today. Certain at least stand in the way of moving forward with paragraph 1. If you wish to think about it further and want to do something.
Mr. Chair, what I'll do is I'll think about it, kick it around, talk with Senator Chamberlain between now and the next stop. I don't know enough about this subject in order to give any recommendation. It's just an observation I'm making and nothing more.
Right.
I certainly wouldn't want to make a decision based on not enough information in my own mind just to make change for change's sake.
All right. Are there any further questions or discussion? Is there a motion?
Chair, I move the bill.
Senator Limmer moves that Senate File 131 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Jobs, Ag, and the Rural Development Committee.
Jeez.
Seeing no further discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Chamberlain, Senate File 238.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill came forward last year originally, and it's a notary bill. My understanding of the history is these things have come up now and again over the years. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this forward and have a discussion committee about this bill. Myself, my personal feeling is I'd like to repeal the whole section, but there are some compromises to be made. Basically, what this does is, as you all know, notaries can charge a fee for their service. Currently, the fee is capped at $1. That has been that way since 1983. I included in your file is a brief description of the issue. And in addition to that, being capped at $1, over the years, the fees have increased. The filing fees with the Secretary of State and other costs have increased in the notaries, so we think it's reasonable to say instead of repealing it, we'll ask for a $5 cap. I think that helps out the rural community. There are some concerns out there that if there is no cap on it, that they would raise the cost of notary fees to any level they wanted. So the $5 cap, the notaries have said they can live with that and that'd be reasonable. With that, I have a testifier that would be happy to give you a little more information.
Mr. Jessup, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Be sure you sign in on the sheet there.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Randy Jessup. I am the owner of two UPS stores, one in St. Paul and one in Roseville. And I represent a number of other folks just like myself who have small businesses and where we perform notary service for the general public. As Senator Chamberlain mentioned, we did look to pursue repealing this this law on the books completely, and at this point we're definitely content if we can move forward and at least move that cap up to $5. A couple of additional observations for you all. Last year, House Representative Linda Runbeck had touched base with the Secretary of State and a gentleman's name, Bert Black, who is in the legal, I think a legal advisor or serves with the Secretary of State. He did mention that the Secretary of State's office is definitely in favor of, certainly at that time was just removing this this law completely, but I think they would certainly be in favor of going ahead and making that maximum up to $5. One other statistic for you is that I know of that I had touched base with the Secretary of State's office. In 2008, there was over 100,000 notaries serving the state of Minnesota. And in 2011, that number had decreased to about 85,000. So it was a decrease of 15%. So one of the concerns is with the raising of the fees to become a notary, there also is increased liability when you are a notary, that we are seeing in general those individuals coming forward to be notaries has decreased. And that is certainly to the detriment of the general public. So we anticipate that by going ahead and revising this, letting the maximum go to $5, that as well, perhaps there will be more notaries in the future servicing the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Mr. Jessup, or is there anyone here who knows why there was a fee limit put in place in the first instance?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I imagine the issue may have been the same as it is now. I was advised that rural communities and some other people were concerned about notaries raising the price too high and not having any alternatives, especially in the rural communities. That's what I learned about the current bill, so I can only speculate on why it was originally only $1.
Is there anyone here from a rural community that can add to that? Certainly don't want to cause rural community residents to have to pay exorbitant notary fees, but I'm struggling with the question that you've raised, which is why have a cap at all, number one, and number two, this just illustrates the danger of putting actual dollar figures in statute because they very quickly become outdated, and it's a process to go back and change it. My first year in the legislature, the interest rate that can be charged on money that was held in escrow by rental property landlords of the renters was in statute. I think it still is. We had to change the interest rate because it was outdated. And I don't know why it wasn't pegged to some other benchmark and just stated so in the statute so it could be adjusted every 6 months or a year. Why we would lock it into statute, I don't know. So I'm wondering about this, too. Maybe other committee members have a thought.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, when I first started in the legislature, there was a usury law in Minnesota, too, where an 8% rate was the maximum charge anyone could make. Then it quickly, mortgage rates and due to economic conditions, they went sky high, and we quickly changed because the contract for deed market couldn't keep up with the marketplace. But I do have a question on this. If we if we let the unbridled free market system move forward. The only question I have is, and it's one question, on line 14 we have the word which is kind of an old word called folio, and I'm assuming, is that per page? And maybe council could give me a reference on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Lumber, I did actually look that up. So I had the same question. That's a really archaic term.
I'm glad you did, because now I don't feel so dumb.
It's like a giant piece of paper that you could like fold in half, so it'd be like pages in a book.
Okay.
And but it looks like it's used more as reference to like a document or a page, depending on the context of these fees here. But I think the original law is like 100 years old.
So, Mr. Chair and Council, if someone came to avail themselves of a notary copy, and I haven't seen too many folio pages lately, would they charge $1 for $5 for a folded piece of paper, or would it be $5 for an 8.5 by 11? And I don't know what this means anymore. Is it one of these antiquated references that maybe the reviser should look at and give us a reference?
Well, maybe whatever we do, we can recommend that the reviser look at that and consider including in the reviser's bill an update to that language.
Another question.
Is that an appropriate procedure, Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, we can check on it. I can put it on my list of things to do, figure out.
Like you've got nothing else on that list.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lumber.
One of the other questions I have is as you know, I practice in the real estate business. And if I'm reading this correctly, if a notary public that happened to be at a closing table, could they charge up to $5 a page for a real estate closing documents? And sometimes they're 40 to 80 to 100 or more pages. Could they actually be charging $5 a page? Is that what we're allowing to happen?
Jessup?
Sure. Senator Lumber, I'm not in real estate, so I'm not your expert to your previous discussion earlier. My expectation, as we observe in all other goods and services across the state, is there's supply and there's demand. And, I look at the services of an attorney. For instance, well, the service of an attorney could charge whatever that attorney so desired. But is anyone going to go ahead and hire that attorney if his fees significantly outweigh or are way in advance of his competition? I would say the same would apply here, is that each person that would be responsible at a closing for assisting in getting that real estate transaction closed is going to have fees that would be commensurate with their competition. And I would not anticipate that those fees would rise. I personally would not anticipate those fees would rise to $5 per transaction if there's 40 notary stamps to make that transaction complete. I would not anticipate that, because I would not anticipate that others in that profession would be doing the same. I anticipate that there would be that would be subject to the laws of demand and supply, as every other service is.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lumber.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure there's other legal services that could expand that need for having notary copies, but a real estate closing is rather a unique sale. It's usually in a little room with buyers and sellers and the agents. I've sold a lot of properties over 34 years, and I've never once anticipated, much less called ahead to check the market price of a copy of a piece of paper at a closing. There are times when a title company will have title services and fee, and it'll be a total for doing all the work of transacting the sale. But even at that point, those are rather big numbers, and they're relatively the same across the market. But I don't think the market calls ahead and says, what's the copy fee charge in your office? And I'm just a little concerned that someone would walk into a real estate closing and get stuck with a $500 bill, all for making copies on a machine that probably spits them out for a nickel apiece. So that's what I'm concerned about.
If I may.
Mr. Jessup, yes.
One other point, just for all of your edification, is surrounding states have different laws in regards to maximum notary, what you can charge. And in the state of Iowa, there is no limit. There's no regulation on the books. So a notary can charge whatever they so desire in the state of Iowa. In the state of North Dakota, the limit is $5. In the state of South Dakota, the limit is $10. And surprisingly, in the state of Wisconsin, to be fair, the amount is 50 cents. But to that point, I would just suggest, Senator Limmer, that I'm certain that they have already dealt with this issue that you are speaking of in North Dakota, South Dakota, and in the state of Iowa. So I would not anticipate, I would anticipate if there was a scenario as you are suggesting that would have been raised in those three neighboring states.
Senator Latz?
Senator Sharon.
Well, we know that Wisconsin's a business-friendly state. But my question is, anybody can apply for a notary. It's just a fee. Is there a process in which the person has to learn the responsibilities or the role of this notary? I mean, everybody in the country could be a notary if they wanted to be, as I understand it. Is that true?
Mr. Jessup?
My apology, I'm going to miss your name. Is it Senator
Sharon?
Sharon?
Senator Sharon, right.
Thank you. Yes, there is a process. You don't go through it at renewal. You can renew your notary every 10 years. But at the time that you become a notary, you go and you apply and you take an oath, an oath that you will serve the state of Minnesota, the Secretary of State's office. You do have to be a resident of the state. You do have to show, I think, your driver's license for proof of residency. So it cannot be anyone. It does have to be a state citizen. And so, yes, for the most part, if you are a citizen of this state, you can apply to be a notary.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
And if I'm not mistaken, there's also a fee for that to become a notary?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I was a notary at one point and would like to see this raised. I remember many times being called up at home to try to notarize something and, you know, had to pretty much say, well, I'm not going to charge at all because $1 isn't worth charging somebody. But it does take time. It takes effort. You know, I was part of a church situation at the time, so there were people in the church that would call and ask for it, and it was a service. But it does take some time, too, along with the fee that you put in. I think it's every 10 years. So I would be in favor of this.
Senator Latz, may I follow up
Senator
with another
Sharon.
Question? You take an oath that you will... What I understand the role to be is to make certain that if someone signs a document that they are, in fact, the person signing the document. And that's the essential responsibility on which you would do the stamp. Can you help me understand what is the liability issue that we're talking about here? What happens in the liability issue?
Mr. Jessup.
Sure. Thank you. Senator Sharon, what can occur in these situations is, let's say you do sign a document and there's any question that arises on that, you may be called to testify and verify that you signed a specific document. So there's not a liability in that someone is going to, let's say, take legal action and sue you, at least not that I know of. But there is the issue of you are constrained by, if there are any questions that do arise, then you are obligated to attend, you know, whatever hearing on the matter might be. So it's more a matter of, I guess, additional time and effort that would be expended on your behalf. And I personally have not had that happen for a notary situation. I did get called for a very odd situation, and it took a good 2-3 hours out of my day And, you know, it was a specific date that I had to appear, and so I had to rearrange my schedule to do so. And I have heard of other persons like myself who own UPS stores who have had to do that, or they have had to have an employee go ahead and be at one of these sessions. And that's one of the reasons, quite honestly, and I'm expanding here a little bit, but that's honestly quite one of the reasons why we as owners of these establishments will go ahead and we'll become a notary, but we will hesitantly or not at all allow our employees to become notaries because we do not know of the issues that are going to be faced in the future. And given the high expense to become a notary, $120 to the state and then $20 to a county, it just isn't worth our effort. And one of the issues that happens as a result is that notaries in our retail establishments were usually available, if were available at all, were available during the day. Well, just to Senator Hall's point, the need for notary service certainly expands beyond just the day. And there are a number of folks that would love to come to our retail establishments in the evening and be able to get, you know, something signed off. We as owners don't want to do that because of the situation we are in. If this cap is raised to $5, then most likely I will go ahead and at least get notary for two additional employees. That would be a benefit to the community within the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Paul.
Could somebody tell me what a dollar in 1983 is now worth today?
Senator Mr. Chamberlain.
I thought about doing that calculation, but I did not, Senator Holmes. It's the average 3% over 30 years future value there. I'm not quite sure what that was, but I thought about it. I just didn't do it. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
I would assume it's more than $5.
Right.
Probably even more than $10. I would like to move a friendly amendment to change this to $10.
There's a motion on the table, but Senator Hall, in response to your question, our crack research staff here has determined that $1 in 1983 is worth $2.31 now.
Really?
Big spender.
So you're going to get a reputation as a tax and spend liberal, Senator Hall. I'm sure you want to proceed with
right
your
after
amendment?
My friend Limmer.
We have the actuarial all prepared, Mr. Chair.
Senator Letts.
Senator Sharon.
I just want to know, Senator Hall, to know that I do not want to support the amendment. I'm struggling a little bit with the $5 because my experience in the rural area with notary publics is that it's more of a service than it is anything, and that people really get this, pay this fee, become notaries, and really offer this service without any charge. And I understand the testifier to say that the number of notaries is reduced and is suggesting that something like this would resolve that issue. I'm not sure about that, but I do care about not increasing this fee so substantially that it really makes it difficult for people who would seek to get a signature notarized. And for some people, $5 is a lot of money. So I was willing to support the original language, but I would start to quake a bit at moving up to 10. So I just wanted you to hear that ahead of time.
Okay. Ms. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hall.
I understand that. I will withdraw that motion. But I think that, first off, someone that is a notary and wants to be a service can be a service, even with a cap on it, you know. And so,
Senator Hall, I agree with that. But I do think that that when Senator Limmer was talking about the people, it's sort of like the Tennyson warning on email addresses. Is people just generally don't know that they might have a choice to go to a different notary, or it just isn't, you know, the frequency with which you get, unless you're in a business where you're getting notaries all the time, like Senator Limmer with his business or in our business. But lots of times this is a once-a-year or once-in-a-lifetime activity that goes on or very rare. And it's just not something that people shop around. I'm going to shop around from the cheapest notary. I just don't think that's the concept here. So,
Madam Chair,
did you withdraw your amendment?
I did withdraw.
And did you want to make a motion on this?
Yeah, I would move Senate File 238.
Let's see. This bill moves to the Senate floor. Is there any further discussion? Okay, so we have a motion to approve Senate File 238 and refer to the floor of the Senate. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Members. Senator. We are going to have a brief recess of the committee. Senator Latz's bill is here, and he'll be returned shortly. So it could be as little as, anybody have any idea how much time I should give here? 15. About 15 minutes. Thank you. I have to